the topic is not something, is not Jeremiah for me. It is something I feel passionately about, but I feel passionately about it because of my life experience and what I've noticed in my, what I've seen in myself and my students and my children primarily, and some reading. I wrote a blog about it, and someone, Stuart Scott Lee, invited me to come and share out of my feeling about the topic. It has to do with education. This is the first fall in 56 years that I haven't been getting ready to start back to school, either as a student or as a teacher. 23 years at BTSR, been teaching postdoctorally after I got my degree for 30. I was very young when I started out. Quite the prodigy. Along the way in my education, I did an honors degree at Samford, and the curriculum was integrative, cross-disciplinary. And I just loved it. I just loved encountering how history and science or psychology and mathematics or literature, you know, relate to one another. You have to specialize in something to get a degree. You got to be an expert in something. But the world doesn't come in those kind of categories. The world comes in as a whole. And I just loved it, loved that degree. And when I began teaching undergraduates, as it happened, I got involved in the honors program, and very soon I was honors director. And during my time at Carson Newman College in East Tennessee. And I loved that, working with the 200 brightest and students on campus. And we did interdisciplinary course. I told the faculty, I had a sort of a bounty out. I said, you may think your discipline has nothing to do with your friend's discipline, but I guarantee you, I will fund out of honors funds, I will fund the development of a course if any two of you will come together. And I had an art professor and a history professor who taught a course in Star Trek as a sort of a modern, you know, Odysseus and all that kind of stuff. It was at a course in ninth taught by an English professor and a sociologist entitled 1968. When we put it on the catalog, in the catalog, the student said, 19, are you going to have a whole course in just 1 year? And we said, you bet we are. Wait till you find out about that year. And it became one of the most popular courses. Okay. So my kids come along, and you know how it is. My wife, by the way, is the director of the International Baccalaureate Program at Henrico High. And it, too, is a very interdisciplinary sort of... Well, all along the way, with students I've taught, with my children somewhat, my wife encounters this almost on a daily basis, the rush to get finished and the rush to get to a career, as so much so that I had honors parents wanting to know how 1968 was going to help his daughter become a medical doctor. Well, in ways you can't imagine. Right, but it's going to happen. I got spurred on to write a little essay about this when this business of the parents buying their kids into college, famous parents, hit the news because it just stirred up all. You talk about helicopter parenting. That's helicopter parenting. That's lawnmower parenting. You know, that's just right down, mowing it off at the top of the. Here, I'll take your test for you, dear. I mean, it just brought back. I didn't have to deal with that as much in seminary, gladly, teaching seminarians, but it brought back all those college. My phone would ring, and parents would just be livid because their child had made a B in an honors course. And if they weren't taking honors courses, they're harder. They'd have all A's, and they'd look. You know. So, I invite you to enter into this in the spirit of a discussion with me. What do we want education to be for? I grew up, I'm the only non-engineer mechanic in among the men in my family. They all, we have family reunions and holidays, and they all look at me and say, now, what is it you do again? My children say, yeah, you go out there, and he'll be sitting at the desk looking off into space, and he claims he's working. So, but I do have enough of that background that I always approach things by, here's the problem, what's the best way to go about it, and what's the proper tool? So if we define what education's for, what its objectives are, then the rest of it ought to come a little more easily. We can find the right tool. Well, of course it's for a career, but you don't start there. That's not what first graders should be interested in yet, or ninth graders either, although they are by that age, and some of their parents are. What's the most fundamental thing we want from an education for a young person? Well, the first thing, we want those basic life skills, and I would argue that if we don't do that well, we've missed the boat. All the rest of it can't happen. This is the foundation. You're not going to build a house if you don't have that foundation right. And, well, I have the statistics here. I'll see if I can get close to them. The most recent study of these things that ranked students and published in 2015 ranked American students 30-somethingeth out of something-somethingeth. 38th, 15-year-olds in America ranked 38th out of 71 countries. That's below the midpoint in basic math skills. Basic math skills. And 24th in, out of that 71, that's a little better, in science. So I understand the STEM thing. It's important. But we don't have to approach that as an either or, I don't think, do you? Come to that in a minute. But we just think about living your everyday life. If you don't know how to figure annual interest, if you don't know how to do a tip, if you can't read the ingredients on the package, that's all basic stuff. So, and when we come to education, that's got to be done. The second thing, I think, that we, in this country, and I think we're seeing evidence that we haven't done this well, in a democratic republic, in a democracy where it depends on people voting, we need a well-educated voting populace, electorate, don't we? We need them to understand how science works. I get so frustrated when we'll have a cold day in the winter and people say, see there, global warming. No such thing as global. Well, oscillation, it's statistics. It's the average. The average is going up. I heard today that they've had three times as many 115-plus days in Arizona this year as they had in the previous decade combined. That's hot. Things are going to change, right? But if you go to the polls and you don't understand statistics, you're going to have a hard time evaluating who to vote for with regard to issues like climate change. If you don't know history, if you don't know your own history, oh boy, so many things. And I am not active on Facebook. I got on it when the kids were all still at home because I think the term is creep. I wanted to creep my children. I think that's the term. And what you do is you get on there and you've become their friends and don't ever say anything. Shh. Be very, very quiet. If you take this down, and then you just watch their what goes on their Facebook. You can keep track of things, and so I got on there. But then I got gommed on to by a bunch of high school and college friends and all that kind of stuff, and I am just amazed at the ignorance out there. You don't know any of them, and I'm not going to call any of their names, so I'm not being cruel, not name calling, but. Huh? Let's start with the Constitution of the United States. That'd be a good place. Has anybody heard of it? None of my Facebook friends seem to have. Well, not there are a couple, but most of them not. If you come into my place of business and I tell you, you know, no shoes, no shirt, no service, I am not violating your First Amendment rights because I can't. I'm not the government. Only the government can. Oh, well, I seem to have learned that somewhere in high school or before. But, oh, have you? And I don't know if you know this, but there are people in the room who can attest to this more carefully than I can. When I was in school, you had to have civics, didn't we? I had it, I think, 2-3 different levels. Is it taught anymore in the public schools, in high school? And how much of it, Mr. Peden?
It's a requirement for 12th grade.
12th grade. A semester of government and a semester of economics in their senior year in high school when they're paying very careful attention. Huh? A semester of government, and then they graduate, and then they're ready to vote. It's in all of our best interest that by the time a young person graduates high school, they're well educated in not just STEM, but in history, huh? Some political science, Some government, and some economics maybe. So that's an important reason for education. Third one, and this is the one that just gets me going. Remember, I'm saying that education is more than just earning a living. You can get educated to learn a living well, but you need education in order to live a life well. Not just to make a living, but to live a life. I started college as a piano. Music's important. We were talking about this around the table. Music's very important. Music, literature, art, these things are very important in my life. I started college as a piano major, but felt that God was calling me. And if I had the theology now, if I had the theology then that I have now, I would have stayed with piano. But I grew up in North Alabama. No, I grew up in North Alabama, and I felt God calling me. And when God called you, he called you to what? Preach. He didn't call you to play classical piano. He called you to preach. The only question was, were you going to do it on the mission field, in the pastorate, or as an evangelist? That was the question. And by the way, in my early days, I was going to be an evangelist. Oh, you should have seen me in my youth. Had a whole white suit with bell-bottom pants and a blazing red tie and a cross big enough that you could use it to go to battle with, and platform shoes. There are pictures of me, but only I know where they are. and they're going to be destroyed. Just, you know, if you open the envelope, they'll flash into. But if I had the theology now, I think God calls everybody. God calls us to all sorts of vocations, and I would have probably continued in piano. It's worked out okay because when I left piano, I went to religion and discovered that I'm pretty good in languages. And didn't know, I could speak Central Florida or North Alabama when I went away to college. But I found out I was pretty good in languages, right? I play in a band now. I mentioned the music because I play trombone in a swing band. I'd encourage you to come hear us sometime. I'll put in a little plug. We're playing at Glen Allen Day on the community stage at 11 o'clock. We're called Reflections Big Band. You can find us on the Facebook or the web. We're all people who loved music and, with the exception of a couple of people, ended up doing something else professionally. We have a lawyer and a couple of doctors and a dentist and a theology professor, and, you know. I'm the I'm probably the third from the youngest in the band. We have a guy, 93 years old, who plays second trumpet. Still plays a hot. I mean, we come in on our walkers and and set up. And then he goes, one, two, three. I mean, we're hot. We don't play around. This is not Lawrence Welk stuff. We move it. But we have 93. Our bass sax players are really proud of the 93-year-old because that keeps him from being the oldest. He's 89. You see where I'm going? Music has stayed in these people's lives in my life. My wife always says she knows what kind of day I've had and whether she wants to go to the other part of the house by what music I'm playing on the piano when she comes home. That's usually I practice about 4:30. And if I'm playing something sweet, then she comes up and gives me a hug. If I'm playing something that's got a little bit of an attitude, she waits 30 minutes or so and she says, and finds me later. You know, anything that's got any sort of, yeah. I'm not casting aspersions on athletes, but you can play a pretty mean trumpet at 93. I think Jim Shaw's his name. I think his jump shot's probably lousy. You can paint. You can certainly read. All of these things which give you contact with beauty and meaning. I have a good friend who is a medical doctor who was a classical guitar major, an undergraduate. He keeps one of his guitars in the office. I worry about these people who are so career-driven. They get trained in a good career, but they don't have anything to enrich their lives with. Is that part of what an education is? That's part of how we conceive a liberal arts education at the undergraduate level. That's how it was always conceived at the undergraduate level. And yet, you can do some statistics, philosophy departments, departments of belletristic literature, being cut to the bone, some of them eliminated in colleges and universities all over America. History's taught us as a math course now, statistics more than it is about people and movements and ideas. I worry about us. Are we becoming shallower as a people? I know that money my dad and mom spent on piano lessons is more important to me in terms of maintaining my sanity than all of the Xanax and the, well, no, that's not the right stuff. All of one of those things in the world could be, right? My wife will sometimes say, do we need counseling? I say, no, I'll just go practice. We rehearse on Sunday nights, and sometimes, especially if I've been out of town to preach, it rolls around 5 o'clock, and I go, the last thing in the world I want to do is go to a swing band rehearsal. I drag myself in there. Midway's of the third measure. My foot's tapping. Huh? And I'm having the time of my life. Okay, let's analyze. I've said that, okay, education is to get a career. Let's set that aside. We need to make sure when we educate. I sometimes say that the most important people in our culture, in our society, are the K through third grade teachers. We ought to pay them that way, but never mind. We ought to be making sure our brightest young people go into those careers. And they're not now, you know, because it's a thankless job. It's underpaid. You get criticized. Well, this is when my family says, Sunday's coming, you can preach then. Shut up. This is not. I used to hear that around the dinner table when the kids were home. Oh, you did it now. You got him glowing. Somebody shut him up. So, yeah, a career, but we want them to be able, we want every citizen in this society who can to be able to read the cereal box. Huh? We want to know that the people who are going into the voting booth next to us have thought about the issues with on the basis of some level of information. I am so tired of there'll be a big issue, a big question, and on the TV you'll hear, according to a recent poll, 33% of Americans think this and 42 think that and 58 has nothing to do with what is. I don't care if 63% of the people in the poll think that this carpet is red. That's a blue carpet. We want to know they're going into the voting booth, not necessarily thinking like me, but thinking, right? My pet peeve, of course, as you've heard, big one, is that we don't just train people to make money and have a job. You're going to have to live a whole life. I hope that you're educated in something that can give it meaning. I'm going to add a fifth one to this audience because it concerns me a lot. At a couple points in my career, I would just wonder, and so, when did I do this to your class? You'll recognize it or not. I did it when I was teaching honors undergraduates at a Baptist college because I just couldn't believe what was. I would do a first day of class, a two-part questionnaire test. The first part, and I didn't let them see the second part until they'd filled out the first part, ask them all the kind of questions you ask. What are your hobbies? How long, have you been a regular church goer? How long have you attended Sunday school? Tell me about what kind of Sunday school program you had at your church. And they fill that out. Yeah, I've been going to Sunday school every Sunday since I was born, and we have a great ministry of education at my church. I don't know why I'm having to take this course because I know the Bible pretty well. I would take that up, and then I would give them, it was like a 20 question, multiple choice, fill in blank, objective, not hard. The question that just always dismayed me, by the way, the average over several years teaching undergraduates, the average grade was about 40. When I did it for a few years, did I do your class this way? It's not sounding familiar. I did it for a few years in seminary and then quit because I was getting depressed. One question that just baffled folks, apparently, was I would say, put these four biblical characters in historical order. Abraham, David, Moses, and Jesus. No less than about 30% of the class was getting anywhere near that. Yeah, it was terrible. But you know about the Pew research on some biblical literacy. People who identify in America, grown people in America who identify as Christian, I forgot it was some ridiculous number, 53, I'd have to look it up again. It wasn't 100%, but it was over half of the people interviewed thought that Joan of Arc was Noah's wife. Yeah, exactly right. Lord, Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy. Now, I think that we ought to take religious education. Those of us who believe, we ought to take religious education as seriously as we take mathematics. Don't you? We don't. We don't. All those years of seminarians, I love them all. Okay, these two were exceptions. They could have tested out of the course, you know. They already knew it. Oh, three could have tested it out of the course.
We know why he didn't include it.
Yeah. Could have tested out of the course. If we think that education is just about getting a job, then we deserve what we're getting. I've gone on like I was preaching a sermon. I wonder if, and by the way, as I say, it's not so much that I'm an expert on these on this subject as it is that I've lived it for these years and feel pretty strongly about these issues. There are some folks in the room who might know the ins and outs better than I do. And I hope if they will, they'll contribute to the conversation. Does anyone have a question, comment? You can all amen if you want to. Yes, please. Right. Right. Other reason. Music in particular. Oh, yeah. Music in particular rewires your brain. They've done studies on people where they hook you all up. And while you're playing music, and this doesn't, you don't have to be virtuosic. While you're playing music, connections with parts of your brain that they just never see connect together under other circumstances. You're going to town, boy. My mind is working, and it's good for you in that regard. Music also, gosh, I might feel this way about other things if I had been involved with them, but music teaches you discipline. It teaches you, one of the things I think it teaches you that is very important is that no matter how good you are or how hard you try, it's not perfect. You will not attain perfection. I have never given a performance that I didn't walk off stage and say, got to get that measure just before the break in that third tune. I split that note. I got to fix that. So I'll fix that, and then I'll mess up something in another tune, you know, right? Or I've never played the piano. My mother used to say, we're going to make you wear a mask when you play the piano. I said, why? Because she said, because anytime you make a mistake, you grimace as though you've just bitten a dill pickle. And she said, we wouldn't notice it, but you say with your face, oh, that was a terrible mistake. My daughter, who is a professional musician now, when she was playing flute in junior high school, she would come out of a concert. And boy, if you know you love your children, by the way. I had four who were all in band and stuff. And when you go to some junior high school band concert, voluntarily, you love your, especially if my kids were in the band, the strings would always, I would always ask the children, now, are the strings playing first or are they playing second? And well, they would never know, and then it would be all different ways. But because I would like to get out of hearing the strings, because I'm a trombone player, and we play in tune. We've got to, and I get physically ill. I do. I'm not kidding. When something is as bad out of tune as the junior high school wind string ensemble can be, I used to take headache medicine just on the way in the door. I didn't. I have had out of tune music can trigger migraines for me, honest to God. And I just didn't. I don't like migraines, and so I'd load up. And if I couldn't find out when the strings were going to be playing, I'd go. But my daughter would come out and say, "How do we do? How do we do?" And I said, "You did wonderfully for a junior high school band." And she'd say, "What do you mean for a junior high school band?" And I'd say, well, now, Ellen, I don't really think we need to go into that. Just be satisfied that you did really well and that you need to do better. You can do better. And she said, what do you mean? Okay. The flutes were out of tune. The trumpets were not in balance. There was a trombone player who needs to go back and find out, you know, where first position. And she would say, you heard all that? And I said, yeah. She said, but you said it was good. And I said, it was good for a junior high school band. I don't think there's much of anything else in life that will teach. I think that's the way you should live life. Perfectionism is evil. It's a sin. Adam and Eve thought they would be more than they were. They wanted to be godlikely perfect. That was the first mistake. I got news for you. Try to getting two piccolos in the eighth grade piccolos in tune with one another. Just two. I don't mean a whole band, just two.
And you'll give up right now on the idea of perfection, or you'll drive yourself crazy.
Music, in that regard, can teach you a sense of humor. I mean, it can teach you. It can. It did my daughter. She was a perfect. Bryn knows my daughter. She was a perfectionist, and she had to unlearn that, or she couldn't be doing what she is now, because you can't be that way. You have to say, that was a good performance. I'll improve this area, and I'll go back to the practice room. But that was good. That was a good performance. Wasn't perfect. Never going to be perfect. Perfectionism keeps you from. And this is a lesson we all should learn. I mean, music. I can go on forever about music, and what it teaches you. I had a colleague, at a former institution where I taught. First day I met him, there was a stack of papers on his desk, and I said, "What's that?" And he said, "It's a manuscript for my book." And he said, I've been working on it for 6 or 7 years, and I think it's about time to publish it. He said, I'm just going to have to go back to the library one more time, because in the 6 or 7 years since I last did a bunch of research, there have been new stuff written. You see where this is going? I taught with him for 10 years, and when I left, that stack of papers, there were some new ones on top, was still there. And I ran into a former colleague who is still there the other day, as a matter of fact, and I said, what does the corner of his desk look like? And he said, oh, they're still there. They're still there. Because he wanted to get it perfect, right? You'll kill yourself. I've worked on it hard. It's pretty good. Let it go. Writing will also do what music does for you, because I will work and work and work. I do two edits on it before I let my wife, who was an English teacher, see it. And then she inevitably finds stuff. I say, I dare you. She finds stuff. I fix that. Send it off. There are editors at the publisher. They go over it. I go over what they went over. The book comes out. I'm so proud. I open it. Inevitably, the first page I turn to, I say, that comma is not supposed to be there. Never fails. Never fails. It's frustrating. I used to think of the making of books, there's no end, meant that everybody's always going to be writing a book. What it means is you just got to quit at some point, because if you don't, you drive yourself crazy. Music also teaches you to cooperate, especially if you play a band instrument. It doesn't do, you don't, you may want, you may be the sharpest trumpet in the world, but if you're playing third and drowning out the first and there's no balance, then shut up, calm it down, it's not about you. I had occasion to remember recently, it's also about leadership. I had occasion to remember recently an event as I had as a musician, which just shocked me. I was in college. I was playing bass trombone in those days. That's the big, deep one. They had what was called a concerto competition at Samford, and a young man who was the son of a piano professor, and the young man was a prodigy, won. And so they were going to do a concert in which he was going to play the first movement of Tchaikovsky's B-flat minor concerto. It's the one that goes, ya da da dum dum da dum ya da 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 dum da dum ya da da dum dum da dum ya da da dum. I had played that in high school, not as well as he did, but I had played that in high school. But they hired the symphony, and because they were cheap, they hired, if there was anybody on campus who could play a horn pretty good, they hired students, and for everybody else, they hired the Birmingham Symphony. You got that? So I was hired to play bass trombone. We went to the rehearsal. The other trombones were all buddies. And Dad was conducting for Son, right? And Dad was a piano player. And this turned into Dad and Son show, right? And so we had a rehearsal, and I don't know if you know anything about music. Oh. Musicians like to see a downbeat every once in a while, at least. And he's got his slinging his hair and doing all this kind of, you know. Where is one in that? I don't know where one is. He goes by one, you know, just. And so we're sitting there, and the trombones don't play until almost halfway through the first movement. I forgot the number of measures where you're silent. And if you've ever seen band music, that's how it works. There's a little thing there, and it'll say 128. Right. That means you've got to be counting 1, 2, 3, 4. 2, 2, 3, 4. 3, 2, 3, 4. And he's doing this, right? So we're sitting there during the rehearsal, and we're thinking, this is bad. But maybe we'll get to that part, and we can at least hear how it sounds. And maybe he'll cue us. That's when measure before you look back at the trombones and go, it's coming. And then you know. Well, he was too busy doing this and arguing with his son about how to play a passage or so. And the symphony people were union. And so the concert master was watching the clock. And when they got to they had contracted, I think, for an hour rehearsal. And when they got to be an hour, and we were in measure 102, right, they got up and left. So we come the next night to play, right? We hadn't blown our horns during the rehearsal. And we're sitting there, and I'm counting, guessing one's in there. So, one, you know, and I didn't feel confident. So I did what you do as a musician. I leaned over to the second trombonist and said, 118, 2, 3, 4. 116, 2, 3, 4. First trombonist, who was my cousin, by the way, I leaned down. 119, 2, 3, 4. 117, 2, 3. By now, I can't remember what my original count was. I've forgotten what his count was. We're looking at each other like, oh, dear. And then there was about 4 seconds of absolute silence. That was it. That was us. It's too late. I mean, and we had a beautiful part. It was in 3 octaves. It was unison. It restated the theme. It went ba-dum, but just as trombony as you could get, you know, ba-dum, bum, 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 and the rest of the group. And instead of that, it was da-da-da-da. And all of the symphony players that were around us, all of them went, just kept playing. What did that teach me? I mean, it taught me a lot of things about you got to, for one thing, the leader's not about putting on a show up there. If that's what the leader's doing, then the leader's got the wrong idea. Leader's about preparing the unit to do its job. And that's done out of the sight of the people who will eventually see the performance, right? The leader makes sure that everybody's prepared. And then the leader gives a downbeat every so often. For heaven's sakes. If you're leading a unit, you say, we're going that direction, at least every so often, right? And if you prepare music, I go on. I think I might write a whole book on what music teaches me besides music, because it's wonderful. All right.
Dr. Bill, you talked about education having greater goals than simply directing us toward a career.
Right.
I'm sure y'all have had this experience before. I don't know if it's a symptom or a cause or what, but I'll meet someone new. I'm one of those people y'all hate that when I sit next to someone on the airplane, I get excited because I'm going to meet a new friend. unless they put the hood
on. Yeah, that's right.
Then I can read some social cues. But so I don't know if it's a symptom of that or cause, but you know, hey, I'm Daniel. Tell me about yourself. Well, I'm an attorney. And so we are what
we do
in our profession, and then 6-7 sentences later, I also have a family, and I don't know if these things are related or just conflating different things, but I think we've so narrowly focused ourselves to be, you know, so much of my identity is wrapped up in what I do professionally.
Well,
I wonder if is that creeping into our education system, or is it a byproduct of, or I don't know. It's just
causal relationship, but this makes me think of all the statistics we hear about the fact that Americans don't take vacations the way other people do. Americans don't even take, a lot of us don't take the full vacation time we're allowed because we're afraid that, afraid something might happen back at work and they might find out they don't need us as badly as they think they do or something. I don't know what it is. Or afraid that the boss will think that's a sign we're not as committed as we could be, or I don't know what it is, but we work ourselves to death. And if since we do, I mean, there is a symptom that this all does wrap up into the idea that professional attainment, work, whatever you want to, is how we, the thing we prize most. And I don't know about that. I'm certainly proud of what I've done professionally and want to do some more of it. But I hope I don't think of myself first and foremost as a Old Testament professor. If the truth is known, I think of myself more as a musician than I do as a where my mind is when I'm by myself and it's free to go where it wants to go, it's to music.
But that makes me think, you're connecting that to Sabbath time is interesting because if I can push back against the academy, we, particularly the theological academy, we should know better. When someone gets a sabbatical, well, what's your project going to be?
Yeah,
what are you going to write?
Yeah.
When I'd love for someone to say, well, I'm sort of going to do original Sabbath.
You don't tell that to the people who give Sabbaths because you don't get one. You don't get the first one. But here I can fill you in on how academics feel about that a little bit. We want to be writing all the time, and when you're teaching and going to committee meetings and all that kind of stuff, it's very difficult. So having the freedom to actually devote a little concentrated time on the project you're interested in feels like rest. Amen? Yeah, feels like rest. Yes?
Just to piggyback on that, though, with the Lilly Foundation grants for ministerial sabbaticals,
mm-hmm.
The surest way not to get one
is to say,
too practical.
Yeah. Well, that's because the Lilly people
are too study-oriented.
Yeah. Well, the Lilly people are smart.
Yeah, and theirs is based in study and research on what type of sabbaticals actually benefit the minister and the congregation. So it's based in years and years of research on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it backs this idea that the sabbatical should be
re-energizing.
Yes. You got to rest right, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. You have to. And by the way, my colleague Beth Newman, my former colleague Beth Newman, was a systematician at BTSR. Her recent work, so she started out her work, a lot of it was on hospitality, but that has morphed it recently into leisure, and not leisure as in, go play golf, but she's doing work, the importance of having the leisure to let things gestate. I know how hard it is when, in an academic career, there's a time when you're just trying to get something published. Please publish this. Would you publish this, please? By the time you get to be where I am, people are asking you, would you write a 15-page piece for this or for that or for the other thing? And I usually say yes, but then you've said, I will write you 15 pages on something. I don't know what. I don't have anything right now on the top of my head. And so then you say, oh, that's coming up. And so you sit down with the Bible or the computer or whatever. You go, okay, now, hurry, have an original thought. Now. You need it. It's time. You have it on the calendar to have an original thought today at 3 o'clock. It's 3 o'clock. Have the original thought. You know that's not how it works. Not how it works at all. You have to have the leisure to cogitate, to roll things around, to remember, to ask yourself a new question. I don't know how many things I've written that have come out of, well, I'll be dogged, I didn't ever notice that. Well, I reckon why that is. And for a week in the library and I've got a book, or the seedling for one, or an article. And it comes out of, well, looky there, moments. Oh, never thought of that. And you cannot force those. I mean, in your life in particular, just pray for him every Sunday. You're supposed to say something worthwhile. Yeah, I in that regard, I think of the prophet Jeremiah, who had that run in with Hananiah, and Hananiah said, "Oh, Jeremiah, you're all wrong. The Lord's going to deliver us in just a few days." And Jeremiah said, "Well, I hope you're right, but I don't know, and I don't have a word from the Lord on this issue." And so Jeremiah went home, and some days later, the text says, the Lord spoke to Jeremiah and said, "Jeremiah, you go tell Hananiah he was bad wrong. Besides which, on top of that, he was so bad wrong, he's not going to live very much longer." But Jeremiah did not, in that moment, say, "Well, I'm Jeremiah the prophet. I have to have an opinion on everything." He honestly said, "I hope you're right, but I don't know, and I don't think so, but I don't know. I'm not going to claim, prophetic authority when God hasn't spoken to me." And I think that there's a sense of, yeah, let me go home and think about this. If we were all willing to do that more often, we'd be better off. A lot less bloviation in the world. The roommate said, "You're just bloviating. You're bloviating." Other questions or comments? We're running right up against the quarter after hour, and I don't want to be abusive of anyone's time.
Questions or comments? Pushback, affirmation?
Most everybody in this room's already got your education, but you have children and grandchildren. And I know this younger generation somewhat. They're in a hurry. They're in a big hurry. I don't know where they're hurrying to, but they're in a big hurry, and they need to be slowed down. Let some of life seep into you at a deep level. I worry about them. Thank you for having me here, and just be glad it wasn't Jeremiah, boy. We wouldn't be leaving until sometime next week. I tell you another thing. I haven't lectured to a classroom of people I said it's been 56 years since I didn't start back to school. This has been the longest I've never lectured. I haven't given a. It's a miracle I'm not having some sort of anxiety attacks over it. So thank you. Oh, it feels so good.